This podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Hi everyone, and welcome to Pro Bono Radio at Queen's Law. We're your hosts, Andrew, Glenn, and Chris. Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is a two-parter as we explore why are American courts becoming so politicized? What's the problem, and is it a problem that can happen in Canada as well? We're excited to have Professor Alyssa King from Queen's Law and Professor Paul Gardner from the Political Studies Department from Queen's University joining us today to share their insights, knowledge, and thoughts on this topic. Thanks for joining us. Professor King joined Queen's Law in 2018 from Yale Law, where she received her PhD and her JD. She worked as a law clerk for Judge Barentine D. Parker of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and Judge Nicholas G. Garofis of the Eastern District of New York. Recently, Professor King has been working on keeping track as to how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting procedural changes to courts and alternative dispute resolution procedures. Professor Gardner was a visiting researcher at the Center for Law in the Contemporary Workplace at Queen's Law and is currently an assistant professor of politics and law in the Political Studies Department. He received his PhD from Princeton University, and his academic interests are broadly in American law and politics. He describes his work as sitting at the intersection of a number of subdisciplines of political science, including American institutions, judicial politics, American political development, law and society, and political behavior. They both have deep experience and knowledge in subjects that are pertinent to our topic, and we're very lucky to have them with us today. Thank you so much again. So before we jump into this interview, given that our audience is primarily Canadian and the primary focus is on the federal courts, we thought it might be helpful to provide a quick brief on some of the background information to help contextualize on American courts and the court system. Firstly, what do we mean by politicization of the courts? It can mean a lot of things and manifest itself in a bunch of different ways. But for the purposes of this interview, we mean the systematic effort to appoint partisan judges through almost any means necessary who are expected to rule through an ideological lens rather than fidelity to precedent, the law, the rule of law, and the Constitution. Secondly, I know we got some great comments from Professor King because she has a questioning face. Secondly, like in Canada, where we have provincial and a federal court system with different jurisdictions, the Americans have state courts and federal courts, but there are a number of key differences, one of the most important being jurisdiction. The Supreme Court of Canada serves as a national courtroom for the country, whereas the Supreme Court of the United States, or SCOTUS, is specifically a federal court. The U.S. federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, meaning that they only exercise powers granted to them by the Constitution and federal law. So, for example, federal courts have jurisdiction over the United States government, the Constitution or federal laws, controversies between states or between the U.S. federal government and foreign governments. So if there's a claim by an individual to receive money from a federal government program like Social Security, a claim by the government that someone has violated federal law or a challenge to actions taken by a federal agency might all be heard in federal court. And in contrast, most family matters are addressed in state court since federal court jurisdiction granted by the U.S. Constitution does not include this area of law. And they also cover cases from people who are from different states. So, for example, if a state Supreme Court issues a ruling strictly relating to the state constitution or state laws, SCOTUS may not step in and intervene. However, should that ruling affect federal law or there are state actions that conflict with federal statutory law and U.S. constitutional law, then the Supreme Court may hear the case should it be appealed to them and they choose to hear it. Sound good so far?
One thing is, I do want to emphasize the importance of what's called diversity jurisdiction. That's diversity of citizenship jurisdiction, where there are parties from different states. That gets a lot of state issues into federal court.
So this stands in contrast to, obviously, what we said before, where the Supreme Court of Canada may hear and rule on all legal matters as it's Canada's final court of appeal. The American federal court structure is also similar to ours, but their naming scheme is different. Our federal courts are their 94 district courts, which are 94 geographical districts. Our federal courts of appeal are their 13 circuits court of appeal, with the same idea with 12 geographical circuits and one federal circuit in Washington, D.C., which is the only federal court which is defined by subject matter rather than geography. And finally, we end up with the Supreme Court of Canada and the U.S. with their slightly different jurisdictions. Finally, how we appoint our judges is different. Judges in Canada can simply be appointed as long as they fulfill some requirements, though typically judges are appointed from a list screened and drafted by a judge nomination committee filled with experienced members of the legal community. How judges are appointed at the state level, though, varies widely in the United States. There are five primary methods of state judicial selection, being partisan elections with typically Republican and Democratic judges on the ticket, nonpartisan elections with no party labels, appointments by the legislature, appointments by the governor, and a merit selection process where the governor selects a name out of a list generated by a nomination committee. Federal judges at the U.S. level are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So there are a number of similarities and differences between our court systems, but these were really the ones that we wanted to focus on for the purpose of this episode. So the U.S. process of selecting judges, legislative appointments, electing them, having them nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, leading to our first question, appears to be more open and democratic than the Canadian process. Yet it seems to be choked by abuse and partisan gridlock. Was it always like this? And what's going on?
So when you say, has it always been like this? I guess the answer is yes and no, right? So Supreme Court appointments have always been political, right? We can go back to the elections of 1800 when John Marshall is appointed Chief Justice in part to sort of combat the policy priorities of the incoming Jefferson administration. And you can point to other sort of political features, right? Ronald Reagan appoints Sandra Day O'Connor in order to appoint a woman to the court for political reasons. You know, Dwight D. Eisenhower appoints Earl Warren to the court in exchange for his support at the Republican National Convention, and later calls him one of the greatest sort of regrets that he has of his presidency, right? So there's always politics involved in these appointments, but what seems to have changed is really the extent to which ideology and politics are bound up together, right? So as political polarization has increased in the United States more generally, we're seeing that make its way into the courts, right? So the political polarization that's inflecting so many things in American politics has a number of consequences that we can see on federal courts, right? So we can see that there's a greater desire for litmus tests, right? Presidents want to make sure that the ideologies of judges are going to match their own sort of policy priorities. And so that is something that's increasingly looked at, right? That's something that presidents are more concerned with, making sure that there are records, and it even affects the kinds of judges that get appointed, right? Increasingly, we see Supreme Court nominees being drawn from the federal courts of appeal, where they have records that presidents can look to. But politics has certainly always been a part of the process.
Yeah, I would agree that politics has always been there. One of the things that there's a couple different threads of modern politics that we're seeing in the appointments fight. So some people point to Robert Bork's attempted appointment right during the Reagan administration that was heavily politicized. One of the reasons why was Bork had worked for the Nixon Justice Department, had been involved in defending Nixon to a greater degree than other Republican lawyers were willing to do. So then his record gets picked apart, and there's a lot there. He's quite a punchy writer and doesn't hide his views. Other people would point to Bush v. Gore and the partisan vote on whether to continue counting the vote in Florida. Others might point to the strategy of Republicans of filibustering judicial nominations during the Obama administration, and then the breaking of the Senate filibuster around nominations that followed that. So there's been various sort of partisan fights in recent history that have kind of led to the current perceptions around polarization of the court. One of the ways that presidents have responded has been to pick judicial nominees for lower courts who are younger, who don't have as much of a record that can be picked apart, and then have those nominees already in the federal court system to nominate for appellate judgeships or potentially for the Supreme Court later, right? So that a party sees this as a long-term political strategy. And we also see younger nominees for the US Supreme Court, again, a sort of attempt to lock in your appointees for longer, because another difference with Canada is that the federal courts in the United States don't have a set judicial retirement age.
Yeah. So in addition to some of those sort of specific things, right, Bush v. Gore, Bork, there's also a sense among Republicans that there were a number of Republican appointees that just didn't deliver for them on their policy priorities, right? Anthony Kennedy and David Souter were consistently generally pro-abortion in their decisions, which is not sort of what they were appointed to do. And even Chief Justice Roberts now gets criticized for upholding the Affordable Care Act and things like this. So this is a little bit more of a Republican-specific thing that's going on, which is consistent with polarization that we see more broadly, right? With polarization not being symmetrical on both sides, and there tends to be more extremity growing on the political right.
How would you think? How does the opposition handle this then? Because obviously you have critiques, but I feel like a lot of the times they get labeled as partisan critiques and then brushed off. But if you have one side that's becoming increasingly extreme, how do you have the right language to call them out while still being able to have them on board?
So, I mean, that's certainly something that's tricky to do. And I don't know, it depends what your goal is, right? So if your goal is to convince the other side that you have the right kinds of justices, that you have the law on your side, and that their approaches to constitutional interpretation are the wrong ones, then I don't think that you're going to be able to do that. On the other hand, right, there is a sense that there is there's a need to make sure that the jurists that are being appointed are competent, right? That they have backgrounds, that they have a commitment to the law more generally, right? So that's one thing that can be done, right? Looking for levels of agreement. And there still is a sense within the Senate that there are certain qualifications that are going to lead to better judges. But in terms of more broadly trying to figure out how can you, you know, make sure that the other side is on board, I think that's something that's, I don't know that you're going to convince anyone.
Thanks, Professor Gardner.
So with our next question, we're just going to ask, with the appointment of judges in the U.S. being a heavily politicized affair, what does a politically split court like the one in the United States mean for the decisions they release? Can a 5-4 court, now a 6-3 court, ever deal with decisions in a non-politicized manner?
So my first reaction would be yes, because there isn't a clear partisan valence to many of the things that the Supreme Court deals with. The other thing is that doctrine really is constraining to most judges, right? You've been trained essentially your entire adult life, starting in law school, to view doctrine as a constraint on what you can decide. And although legal realism definitely has an influence on how lawyers view law in the United States, I think that for most judges, doctrine still does set certain parameters. So the first reaction is, yeah, in a lot of cases, they're not going to be 5-4 because they are not issues where there's a clear partisan valence, and also because doctrine will constrain what some judges can do, even if they want to do something different.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. So some scholars like to distinguish between easy cases and hard cases, right? So what are the sort of political questions that are being presented? And so some of those easy cases, some of those more straightforward cases are going to be resolved in a more simple manner. But as political scientists, sometimes we even want to be able to distinguish, can we tell when a decision that's being made sort of on more political or policy grounds versus legal grounds? And that's not always so easy to do, right? But we can point to a heavily politicized case that was recently handed down by the Supreme Court, the Bostock case with sexual orientation and gender identity in the workplace, right? So if people can be fired based on their gender identity. And Title VII of the Civil Rights Act says, well, you can't be fired on the basis of sex. And there was an expectation that this Supreme Court was not going to be favorable to an interpretation that sex would include gender identity and sexual orientation. But we saw that Justice Gorsuch and Justice Roberts ultimately sided with the traditional liberals, the Democratic appointees on this question. And is that evidence that that Gorsuch and Roberts have sort of a greater commitment towards legal principles in some ways? No, not necessarily. We don't know exactly why those decisions came down. And in fact, I always think it's interesting when people assume, right, that Justice Gorsuch and Justice Roberts, for example, might not have sort of policy preferences that say that people with different sexual orientations or gender identities, like maybe that's just what their policy preference looks like. So there are always going to be cases, and right, this will be a continued debate about, you know, can the justices come together on these things? But each individual case presents different kinds of issues, and we're not always going to know what's behind justices' decisions in those cases.
Great. I think when we think of politics within the United States Supreme Court, at least, one of the main kind of sets of cases that we look to are the aforementioned Bush v. Gore and other cases that kind of toyed with the US political system and how elections work in the states. So other cases such as Citizens United with the corporate spending now under now protected as free speech under the US Constitution, and Shelby County somewhat recently in the deciding more with the voter rights side of things. Do you think when cases that deal so heavily with politics come to the court, is there any way that the court can't dip a bit into politics there and just call, as I think Chief Justice Roberts has described it, balls and strikes when he's sitting on the bench?
I think we should start with the lawyer on this question of whether these kinds of decisions have basis in law.
I mean, they do, right? So you brought up Citizens United, right? That's a line of cases coming out of Buckley v. Valeo, which originally equated political spending with speech. And Buckley was authored by liberal justices, right? This is in the mid-1970s versus the textualist is a dissenter. So, Where was Black on that? Sorry. Was Black already off the court by that point? I don't remember. But anyway, the point is that you saw a majority opinion that included Justice Brennan, right? So one of the architects of the Warren Court's approach. And so one of the things that we see is that the partisan valence of certain issues can change over time. Right, as different parties make different use of different parts of the US political system. Now, one thing that we are seeing out of the current cases, right, is that it seems like the Republican Party has decided that in certain states it cannot win with a more liberal voting loss. And so then that motivates the Republican Party and other conservative entities to challenge any attempts to widen the base of voters and to bring those challenges to court, right? Nothing gets to court, nothing gets politicized without a party that wants to politicize it, right? And wants to bring that challenge all the way up to the US Supreme Court. Now, it's also true that the US Supreme Court can refuse to take the bait, right? They have total control, essentially. Minor caveat for cases that involve two states suing each other, but usually they have control over their docket. They can refuse to do what we call granting certiorari to allow the parties to appeal their case there in the first place. And so one thing that we might see is we might see justices worried about perceptions of politicization trying to convince other justices not to grant certiorari on certain cases in order to try to preserve perceptions of the court's legitimacy. Because yes, if they continue to weigh in on some of these issues, they are likely to be perceived as more politicized. And yes, there will be pressure on individual justices to vote the way that their party wants them to. You can imagine liberal and conservative law professors writing amicus briefs. An amicus brief, that's an intervention, right? There's two ways that you can intervene. You can intervene as a party, or you can intervene as a friend of the court. And amicus briefs are interventions as friend of the court. There is a more robust culture of refusing intervention, I will say, than there is at the SCC. But there's still a lot of amicus briefs on a major Supreme Court case, and people will be sending signals to other people who agree with them about how one views the law through that briefing. That you will see people doing that through op-eds, right? There's going to be continued pressure around those cases for sure.
Yeah, as I said before, I think drawing out this separation between politics and law is not only a tricky thing to do, it may be sort of an impossible or even unwise thing to try to do. But, you know, the reason why people point to, for example, Bush v. Gore as an example of a case that maybe looks like it was inflected with partisanship is because the law in the case, right, the legal decisions that were handed down in the case actually seemed to switch normal positions, right? So whereas the more liberal justices usually would be interested in sort of equal protection claims in elections, right, going back to the redistricting cases, right, going back at least that far, the liberal justices in that side dissented against a majority opinion that used principles of equal protection in order to shut down counting of the votes, right? So people are looking at this and saying, well, this actually doesn't look very consistent with how these justices would normally decide these cases. And the key variable that's different is that it seems that it's going to benefit Republicans if the case comes down on this equal protection question or this particular interpretation of the equal protection question. But even there, right, both sides, right, have a sort of a legitimate claim. They've made a reasonable interpretation of the law, I think, on both sides in Bush v. Gore. And so it highlights the difficulty of trying to say, well, what is politics and what is the law? And although there are lots of scholars that are working really hard to do that all the time, it's really quite an intractable question.
Yeah, there's also a federalism question in a lot of these elections issues, because election law in the United States is state law. It's not federal law. And so one of the issues that particularly came up with the last round of elections challenges is the extent to which federal courts should be ruling on those questions at all when it is a matter of interpreting a state statute.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. So on to our next question. I just wanted to ask, for all the outcry and concern about the American democratic and judicial institutions and Amy Coney Barrett's appointment, hasn't the court effectively rebutted Trump's coup attempt?
Wait, but if we're talking about storming Congress 2 weeks ago, that was Congress. That's up to Congress to solve. That's not something that the court's going to be asked to get involved in, right? So Congress has to solve that by making decisions about whether or not certain members will be subject to any sanction for having encouraged it. They are, right, they've impeached President Trump, and now there is potentially a trial in the Senate. There are arguments about whether or not you can try a former president in the Senate and whether the process should follow the same rules as a trial of a sitting president. I think there may be some attempts to legalize that political dispute, but I'm not sure that they will get very far under the political questions doctrine. This is something that the representative branch of government has to deal with.
Yeah, and to the extent that we're talking about all of the various sort of election challenges in courts throughout the various states, right? So we might be heartened a little bit that what were essentially frivolous lawsuits in many cases were thrown out on the basis of standing, or in many cases were actually heard to, you know, to the final merit stage, and were, you know, the Trump campaign just did not have good legal arguments in these cases. And so we might be somewhat heartened about that. I mean,
these were so frivolous. These were really terrible claims. Part of it is just that the lawyering was so bad.
But like, even like, there,
really awful.
So yeah, we shouldn't be too enthusiastic about the fact that these really bad cases were thrown out. But what concerns me, right, is that if you listen to the rhetoric on the right, Trump supporters, about what happened in these cases, it's really sort of, it's going to have negative impacts on the legitimacy of the federal courts, because they believe that these cases were identifying legitimate instances of fraud, and that these cases were thrown out for political reasons, right? That the federal judiciary is part of, for lack of a better term, the deep state, right? And so that has really broad implications for what happens on the courts going into the future. So yes, we should feel good that frivolous cases don't make their way through the courts, even if the president's behind them, but we should feel pretty bad about what effect it's going to have on our justice system in the long term.
I actually had a quick question. Is there any precedent for this type of skepticism of the judicial institutions in the United States? So there is a history. I was wondering if you could talk about it.
So one place you might look is the Lochner era, right? So this was pre-World War II, during the Great Depression. The Supreme Court was a bit behind the times. They were attached to what was called the free labor ideology, right? That they were going to limit the government's ability to interfere in any contracts, especially contracts of employment. That's the Lochner case. Right, preventing the setting of maximum hours for bakers, which is a very physically demanding job. And they were against a lot of federal measures trying to use the Commerce Clause, which gives power to Congress to deal with the economic depression. And the court's views were kind of widely discredited among the progressives of the era, but it sort of beyond just the progressives, right? President Roosevelt had quite wide support, and Roosevelt threatened to pack the court, right? He threatened to add new justices for every justice over, I believe it was 75. And the idea of doing that was to bring in justices who would view the law in his terms. And Roosevelt was reelected in a landslide, at which point we had what's called the switch in time that saved nine. The Supreme Court softened its views on the powers of the government to regulate the economy during the Great Depression. So we've definitely seen periods of polarization and rhetoric, so much some of the rhetoric you're getting now, right? Which is that the courts just don't understand the realities of people's day-to-day lives, that they are in the pocket of corporate interests, right? I think generally judges tend to be relatively small C conservative. So it's not surprising, right, that the complaint is that they haven't kept up with the times. And like a real sense that the Supreme Court's restraining Congress's regulatory powers and the president's regulatory powers was a danger to the country.
Yeah, there are other episodes too, right? So I mentioned the election of 1800, right? The Federalists prior to the election really stacked the federal courts with Federalists. And this had consequences through the 1820s and 1830s, right? With declaring, striking down various sorts of priorities of the Jackson administration. And then what is widely considered one of the worst Supreme Court case decisions of all time, the Dred Scott case, where Chief Justice Roger Taney thought that he could solve the slavery question by, declaring Black Americans slaves unable to ever be citizens of the United States, which was a huge precipitating factor of the Civil War, right? So there are certainly moments where courts were perceived as political, acted in ways that were political, and that it undermined people's confidence in them. But it's a little bit rarer to see the sort of sustained attacks that we're seeing, although the Roosevelt administration did engage in some of that in what Professor King was talking about.
So I think it was Elizabeth Warren said last year that one of the ways we could depoliticize the court was to start packing it a bit more and expand the size. Do you think that is something the current system could work with, or do you think it'll go more towards the past systems where it just kind of stacks that side with other politically in line members of the, let's say, the Democratic Party and other than power?
I think there are court reform measures that could work to depoliticize the court, but I'm not sure that just expanding the court and putting your own sort of ideological compatriots on the court is going to help, right? That seems like it could spur on some sort of race to the bottom. One thing that's being discussed is 18-year terms, right? Non-renewable 18-year terms. That seems like it could normalize some of what's going on by making appointments more predictable. Right now, timing, right? We just have to look to the past, the previous one, and then not the one before, but the seats that ultimately went to Gorsuch and to Amy Coney Barrett, the timing of those, when those seats opened up, was such an important factor in politicizing those seats. And so having them come up on regular intervals that every president would get to nominate two justices, I think could do some good. Then there are other sorts of, so Pete Buttigieg during the Democratic primaries was offering this plan where the Supreme Court would be expanded to 15 seats, and then it would have to have some sort of partisan balance. So 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 independents. I don't know how practical ideas like that are, right? Like, first of all, I don't know what an independent is, right? And how that could not be abused by whatever party is in power at the time. But yeah, so I do have concerns that like some of these blunter court packing plans would lead to some sort of arms race, but there should be some serious discussions about whether other kinds of reforms might lead to depoliticization of the court.
Yeah, I think that term limits would do a lot to regularize the process, to have age stop being such a big issue. Another thing, right, is a set judicial retirement age, which is an issue not only on the Supreme Court, but on all federal courts. One way that can be tackled administratively without necessarily looking to the political branches for action is sweetening the deal around what's called taking senior status. When a federal judge in the United States wants to retire, they can do what's called taking senior status. That means that they can continue to sit and they'll continue to hear cases. And that has been important because the ranks of lower federal court judges, especially district judges, haven't been expanded all that much in quite some time. So some of those districts have very heavy caseloads and they need those senior status judges to continue sitting. But this way you continue sitting, you continue drawing your salary, except there's income tax benefits because now you're drawing it essentially as a pension. And you get to control your caseload a little bit more, which is attractive to many older judges. So judges taking senior status and courts, individual district courts and circuit courts adjusting their processes to make it easier for judges to take senior status and continue sitting some but not all of the time could definitely have an effect in terms of opening up seats and therefore making it less, lowering the stakes a bit of these lower court appointments, where on some circuit courts, right, you might not get very many, but these circuits are quite important because, for example, they're the Second Circuit and they sit in New York and this is a world financial center and they're going to get all of the this financial case law. Same thing with Third Circuit, right, which covers Delaware. Now, a lot of that's in Delaware State Court, but some of it does come over to federal court, or the Ninth Circuit, which covers a huge part of the Western United States, and always has a really pressing caseload problem, right? Allowing more judges to take senior status, coming up with ways to adjust their workload and sitting days that they like, could allow you to put more new judges on those courts and lower the stakes.
Yeah, that's a great point, because we should acknowledge, right, that one of the appeals to the sort of straight, blunt court packing is that it doesn't require a constitutional amendment, right? Congress can alter the number of Supreme Court justices on the court through regular legislation, but mandatory retirement ages or term limits would require constitutional amendment, and for that reason are less realistic unless, right, you get bipartisan support, which is something that's rare these days.
And if you're interested in these politics, go read Maren Levy's work. She's a law professor at Duke.
Thank you for that. So our next question is that, do you think that formalities and traditions are enough as protections in the common law, or should they be codified into legislation?
So I'm not exactly sure what you have in mind here. I can take a stab at it, right? Because there's been a lot of talk about sort of Donald Trump as being a norm breaker, right? Somebody who, so much of US constitutional law is not actually codified, right? It's based on, so let's take, for example, the Emoluments Clause, right? Where it says that presidents can't benefit from their office monetarily, but there's not actually any sort of specific mechanism for what should be done if a president is, right? It's left to Congress to legislate on those sorts of issues. And so if the question is it beneficial to write down some of those things that previously presidents, you know, always release their tax returns? Should we write that down in federal law instead of having it be a general norm? Sure, that's probably a good idea. But the other hand, right, when we think about constitutions more generally and how they function, constitutions are these sort of coordination devices that have that are basically parchment barriers, right, that require people of good faith, right, government actors who are either jealous of their own power or acting as sort of civic leaders that are willing to enforce the laws. Because another thing that we see coming out of the Trump era is places where there actually is fairly clear, fairly clear sanctions or fairly clear limits, and an unwillingness of political actors, whether they be in Congress or elsewhere, right? The Supreme Court's unwillingness to deal with some things around immigration law, or at least whatever the case may be, right? There's still a need for actual real people to be willing to stand up and challenge these sort of violations, whether they're challenging norms violations or violations of black letter law.
So in the instance of the Emoluments Clause, even though it is law, but the Justice Department just never pursued it. It's just something that remains kind of in the ether, that's just not well understood.
Well, so there were lawsuits, right? There were, so CRU, the Citizens for Responsible Ethics in Washington, I think they brought some lawsuits, but those lawsuits were faced a lot of standing issues, right? Because you need somebody who actually has been harmed. And so in some cases, other hotels, right, that were competitors of the Trump Hotel in Washington, might have said, well, we made less bookings for various things, right? But so standing is hard to sort of create for emoluments. You need more than sort of generalized standing. You need a specific sort of harm. And then what we saw recently, just in the past few days, right, that eventually some of these emoluments cases did make their way up to the Supreme Court. But in the past few days, what has changed? Well, Donald Trump is no longer in office and the Supreme Court dismissed those cases as moot, right? So yeah, like what you would need is for Congress to write down a law that says exactly what happens when a president doesn't sort of divest of his business interests.
Well, and not only would you have to write down that law, but you'd have to enforce it. And that's a question because the Justice Department would be doing the enforcing on a criminal statute. And the Justice Department is ultimately run by a presidential appointee, right, by the Attorney General. Now, there is a conception within the Justice Department of a difference between political side work and political side staff and prosecutorial work, but it's not that thick of a barrier. Right, prosecutors in the United States have discretion. And a lot of people would argue that prosecutorial discretion should be used in a way that fits with the executive's priorities. Now, at the state level, often prosecutors are elected, right? They're elected in part for how they will use their discretion, and they make promises during their campaigns about how they will use that discretion. Both in terms of, oh, I'm going to prosecute everybody, right? And we're seeing now progressive prosecutors who are promising to use their discretion not to prosecute some crimes. And that's what they were elected to do. At the federal level, right, the Justice Department's policies are shaped by the president. How shaped they should be depends on whether you subscribe to various theories of executive power. But that is a reality. And in terms of the norms that we're dealing with, then we're dealing with statutes and we're dealing with individual decisions within the executive. You could pass statutes that limit those decisions. There are countries, for example, that do not have the same conception of prosecutorial discretion and require you to prosecute where there is evidence of a crime. But that would require changing other things in the system as well. Oh, and another point I should just say about standing, right, which is that there is not public interest standing in the United States. In Canada, there is public interest standing. You can bring a case as a representative of a group that is affected by the law, but not as somebody who was, or an entity that was directly affected already. But in the United States, the harm required for standing has to be much more particularized.
I guess to tack on to the lifetime appointment discussion we had just a bit ago, do you think that the nomination of younger judges that we've seen to the Supreme Court is kind of like the inverse of that, where we're appointing, I think Amy Coney Barrett just had like a few years on an appeals court, I think, and 49. So if we're not going to impose a lifetime limit and she lives, let's say, to RBG's age, that's 40 years on the bench. Do you think that there's any issues there with, in terms of the younger judges getting appointed with less and less experience?
Right. So there's two points here. One is, how does this affect the stakes and the partisan stakes of appointment? And the other is the experience point. So one, yes, if you appoint somebody younger and you have no term limits, that raises the stakes of the appointment immensely, right? And the stakes get higher the younger you go, because this person can presumably have a longer working life on the court and occupy that seat for much longer if you don't expand the court in any way. The second point is experience point. So Amy Coney Barrett, right, was a well-respected legal scholar and did have experience on appellate court. There are people being appointed with way less experience on the lower federal courts. I noticed there's somebody who'd been appointed, graduated law school, I think a year after me. And it's not like I have no experience, but I'm not ready to be a federal judge. And I wouldn't be even if I had been in practice, rather than becoming a law professor. There is a danger that there's something lost with appointing somebody who, particularly to a trial court, who lacks trial experience, because the common law system relies on judges who have that previous experience as trial lawyers.
Yeah, it's worth recognizing that the sort of the constitutional law that the Supreme Court does is very different than what's happening on lower courts. And so there is sort of a certain amount of experience that's required to actually be able to preside over these cases in federal district courts. That's not, right? So in some sense, the judicialization of the Supreme Court is something that's new. We always haven't always had sort of the sort of need or desire to always put lawyers and federal court judges on the Supreme Court. So in that sense, in the ability to sort of engage in constitutional law at the Supreme Court level, it might be less of a concern. But what is, I think, a big concern is sort of life experiences and background, right? We should expect that somebody who sits on the Supreme Court is going to behave in criminal constitutional cases differently if they were a federal prosecutor versus if they were a criminal defender. Right? And we think that somebody's going to behave differently if they were in private practice versus if they served as a community organizer, right, in politics on the ground. So to the extent that what we see, especially in the Federalist Society, is a sort of a pipeline that grooms a particular kind of conservative jurist that goes through, you know, federal judicial clerkships, becomes a law professor, no offense, Professor King, and then makes their way onto a federal judicial court, that really what we're doing is we're constraining the kinds of experiences that
I'm not sure if I've ever been a member of the Federalist Society. I did go to ACS stuff.
To your, as a law professor, but yeah, fair enough, right? But we should be concerned about sort of the broad diversity of experience that's on the Supreme Court. And to the extent that appointing younger justices means that you have to have this very regimented pipeline so that they can sit on the court at 40, then that's concerning to me.
Yes, I agree. Appointing, for example, too many former prosecutors to the bench and not enough people with defense experience has been a problem, not just in the United States, but in lots of other jurisdictions as well. You want a wide range of experiences, particularly on an appellate court.
Yeah, I agree. That's an interesting point that you pointed out, guys. So we're going to wrap it up with the last question of the day. In 30 seconds or less, of all the problems with the American judicial system, what are some lessons and good ideas that Canada should adopt?
You know, we've been talking a lot about sort of the top of the hierarchy with courts. And I'm not sure that the U.S. has a lot of lecturing that it can do with like the functioning of its Supreme Court right now. But some of my other research really looks much lower levels, right? And one place where I think the U.S. does a really good job is sort of the openness of its courts to various kinds of people and grievances. I'm not a Canadian scholar, but my understanding is that generally Canadian courts are a little bit more closed. But the benefit that you get, right, is that constitutional interpretation, as Professor King mentioned in one of her other answers, only happens when cases are work their way up through all of the different levels of courts. And those start with individuals who are having problems or grievances. And when you make courts harder to access, right, by requiring different kinds of claiming or different standards of claiming, it means that, you know, more special interests with more resources are more likely to get their claims heard in courts and up to the highest levels than people who maybe have fewer resources, right? So one thing that I think the U.S. gets right in its court system is that sort of open claiming.
I think that common law systems collectively are going to have to figure out how to handle the pandemic, which is putting a lot of pressure around on traditions of orality and of trials that happen all at once, right? Versus focusing on documents or trials that do not have to happen continuously because you're not trying a case to a jury. And there are hard questions that we're going to have to ask about procedural values. U.S. courts are asking those same hard questions. And I think there's a lot of value in looking at what we're doing, whether our procedural values are similar, and then whether we can learn from each other's approaches to making things easier. I'll mention a small thing, but it's actually really huge, right, is online docketing. So online dockets make life so much easier in so many ways for lawyers. I will say that it doesn't necessarily reach self-represented litigants who are the majority of litigants in provincial courts, as they are often the majority of litigants in state courts. But in terms of being able to file something, in terms of having a situation where if you appeal on one thing, the whole case file doesn't have to go and you don't have to stop procedures around anything else that is happening. In terms of access to information for journalists and researchers, that's actually a little negative example from the US federal courts. PACER is quite expensive. And there have been various efforts to reduce that cost. So that's one thing for Ontario to know as we're implementing online dockets here, is we want to make those dockets more accessible to the public. But you know, it's easier to implement in Ontario now. Why? Because so many other jurisdictions have already developed systems and we can take an off-the-shelf solution rather than having to build it. So I think there's lots of ways that the courts will sort of learn from each other, especially around the pandemic.
Professor King, Professor Gardner, thank you so much for taking the time to join us for this discussion on the American judicial system. We've been very lucky to have the opportunity to learn from you today. And I think before we end, I'd like to reflect on one final point. On the final day of the American Constitutional Convention of 1787, Elizabeth Willing Powell asked Benjamin Franklin, "Well, doctor, what do we got, a republic or a monarchy?" Franklin famously replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." And what I take away from this quote is that democracy takes work. It and the institutions that support it, like an independent judiciary, requires constant engagement and tending to keep it vital. Once again, I would like to thank you for joining us on Pro Bono Radio. And to all of our listeners out there, thanks for tuning in.
Before we end the show, we'd like to say that this podcast does not contain legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Falls student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer.
We're your hosts, Andrew, Chris, and Glenn, and if you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website at probonoradio.com. Thank you and stay safe, everyone.